name is Dick. You'll also hear John, K2, here we go, KC2WGB, John and Dick. Attempt to act as a net control for the Limehouse Technical Net. Meets most Sunday evenings to gather amateurs in the New York City metro area, as well as the guys that sign in by EchoLink and IRLP, but mostly the New York City area. We try to tap into that brain power and teach each other the ins and outs of ham radio and wireless technology in general. And sometimes we get into further, deeper areas of science. A person signs into the technical net by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. This is technical net number 1414 of the series that began in September of 1982. I think it was the middle of September, so we're coming up on our 30th year. Lots and lots of tech nets. A person can... You can listen to past tech nets by going to a particular website, which has already had 200,000 check-ins. That website is amateur radio, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And there you'll see the last 6.5 years worth of recordings of the TechNet, thousands of hours worth of them. And some of them are documented, the earlier ones are documented as to what subject was being discussed during each 10 minutes. And by way of that website, a person can review past material, and also, if he's unable to stay up late enough at night, some guys will download that to some kind of a recording machine and listen to it while they're driving to work or on their lunch hour, things like that. I hear tell that there are college professors telling their students to get a little bit more acquaintance with the way the wireless world really really works. They suggest that their students listen to the TechNet material. So apparently it's educational. It's not 100% accurate all the time. Let me drop. Occasionally we make mistakes. But because of the peer review of the people listening in and telling us what errors we make, or listening to those recordings and telling us what errors we make, we eventually get the errors corrected. Sort of like what Wikipedia does. There are people who've got all kinds of terrible opinions about Wikipedia. Well, as long as you're looking at Wikipedia material, it's been there for, let's say, more than a month. I think its hit rate, its accuracy is extremely high because of that peer review process. Okay, let's check into this time. Oh, by the way, I should tell you what the schedule is going to be. We take check-ins in the beginning. We try to handle as many people as possible in the first hour, giving them brief answers. At the end of the hour, John goes to the mailbag, which used to be called Mel's mailbag. It's now John's mailbag, by which people who don't yet have their license can't talk to us directly on the air, can send in their questions by way of email or snail mail. After that, Paul, WS2N, will tell us what's the latest with National Aeronautics and Space Administration. WS2N is our space expert, and the Mars Science Laboratory, better known as Curiosity, has been doing some extremely good things. Neil Armstrong, you probably know, passed away as a after effect of the bypass operation he had gone to, and he was 82 years of age. Alrighty, let's take check-ins at this time. Give me your call letters and name if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
W-H-R-I-Y, Joe, yes.
AD2BHY, yes.
Okay, we've got Joe is number one. Jim is going to be number two. I'm pretty sure we're also going to get a Ray sign in, KC2CYR. Well, he would like us to discuss circular polarization, and that's also an extremely good subject. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time, K2RIW.
And 2HCN.
2ADC. Name is Ed, yes.
Jen, a question for the first hour, because it's in regards to the antennas, and probably we're going to continue it after that, after Paul also.
Kilo 2, Monkey's Uncle, yes.
US2N, Paul, first base report. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, we've got Wes, Kilo 2, Monkey's Uncle, we got you, and Mr. Alpha Delta Charlie, I think it was ADC. Please give me the prefix of your name, Ed. Prefix of your call?
It's Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Delta Charlie.
Okay, we got you, Ed. Alrighty. Whoops. Anyone else check in? Give me your call letters at this time.
GC2WGB. Questions from the mailbag. Good evening.
Okay, I heard John, and John doubled with somebody. Who was the other person?
Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike Papa. Bill, no questions.
And you copy WS2N, correct, Dick, WS2N.
We got you, Paul. Okay, the first guy on the list was Joe, W2RYY. Go right ahead, Joe.
Good evening, Dick, W2RYY. I was talking to a fellow ham recently, matter of fact, this week, and he's told me something he constructed to enhance the use of a radio receiving either low-frequency transmissions or stuff in the broadcast band. He constructed something he called a box antenna. Now, I don't know the specifics behind it as far as how many feet of wire this thing was, the specific dimensions of the box, but all he said was it had a capacitor on it for tuning the whole kind of assembly, 365 PM capacitor. And he said once you tune this thing to a resonant frequency, or the frequency you want to listen to, and you get this box antenna tuned to the same frequency, it would actually tend to enhance greatly the reception on a broadcast radio or, you know, in a radio receiving low frequency, something like, you know, 160 or 80 meters or something like that. Have you ever heard of something like this? And if so, what's the theory behind it?
Pick up a medium-old transistor radio that had a loop stick inside, a ferrite loop stick. And you're going to see a kind of an inductive resonator. Also, in the old days, which John and I might remember, when you used to have a console radio phonograph-like thing, a great big piece of vertical furniture in the living room. And if you looked in the back door, you saw this great big flat coil of wire. Oh, I guess it was about 3 feet tall, 2 feet wide, probably about 30 turns in there. And it was on a swinging door so that flat chunk of wire could be oriented in various positions to get best reception. When you're down at frequencies like 1 megacycle, the easiest way to get a antenna, because we're 1 megacycle, by the way, is roughly 300 meters. In other words, the wavelength is 1,000 feet. Are you likely to put up a quarter wave antenna? Not a chance. So you don't go for an E-field antenna. You go for an H-field antenna. Mother Nature doesn't care of that electromagnetic wave, whether you pick up the E-field energy or the H-field energy. Half the energy is in each one of them. And so pick up whichever one you want. By way of a ferrite loop stick, which allows you with a reasonably small number of turns and a 365 picofarad capacitor to hit resonance. So the bottom line on an antenna for HF, you're never going to get enough wavelengths of antenna that you have any real antenna pattern. The best you're going to do is a dipole-like pattern, and your antenna is going to be electronically shrunk down. Let me drop. So once you've got something that will resonate, a coil probably around a ferrite material, or the coil itself is physically large so you get enough inductance so you do hit resonance with, say, a 365 picofarad variable capacitor. Once you hit resonance, and once the loss characteristics of your materials is low enough, you will get full performance. After that, the only thing that's going to increase the performance is to orient it correctly, have it spaced far enough away from materials that might be shielding it. So you want to be away from shielding materials, orient it correctly, preferably at a high altitude if you can get it. But you're not going to get antenna pattern. You're not going to get extra gain unless you put the electronic gain in it. So just hitting resonance with low loss materials is the best you can do. There are various things you can buy that are a great big large ferrite like thing that sits on the desk, and it supposedly gives you more gain. I'm having a little bit of a problem with that. If it has less built-in loss of its materials because of larger size compared to some other method of construction, I can accept that. But since you can't change the antenna pattern, and if you can't change the antenna pattern on these electrically small antennas, you can't change the effective capture area. You can only change whether or not the signal that it does pick up gets lost by resistor materials, or gets properly impedance matched and coupled into your radio. So you take, for instance, a buddy of mine wanted to listen to the 160 kilohertz signal being transmitted by that transmitter in Scandinavia, and he started off with a I guess it was a loop of multi-conductor wire, kind of telephone wire, where there's a, let me pick a number, you know, 60 leads inside of this conductor, inside of this insulated black
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
A black 2-inch diameter thing, and he's got about 60 wires in there, and he took a loop of this material, probably a 3-foot or so diameter loop, and by connecting various turns together at the point where the loop's ends are brought together, he made multiple turns inside. And so the multiple turns and the right capacitor across the end and the right kind of impedance matching network could give him an antenna, an inductive antenna that resonated at 160 kilohertz, so that's the frequency you want to listen to, and that just proper orientation is going to give you the reception. So what constitutes a good antenna at the low frequencies takes on some rather different physical and electronic characteristics, but almost all of them are H-field antennas, because you can't get enough wavelengths with an ordinary E-field antenna, a ground plane-like antenna. I wonder if that makes some sense, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Dick, I don't think I explained the question correctly, because it doesn't seem like you're talking about the same thing I asked about. Can I ask it again?
Try again and try to use colorful words, but draw a picture, Joe. Go ahead.
Okay, what this amateur told me he had done, he had taken a box, something he called, a box antenna. And like I said, I don't know the physical dimension of this thing, except the rating of the capacity he told me, but this thing was built external to a broadcast radio. He put the broadcast radio within this assembly, and I guess the thing constructed probably was resembled a box with wire around it, and as he tuned this, the resonance of his box antenna to resonance, the same frequency you're trying to listen to, it greatly enhanced the performance of the broadcast radio. That's what I was trying to get understand what was going on. Not connecting a loop stick antenna to a radio. The radio already had a loop stick antenna within. Now do you understand what I was talking about?
Was there any electronic gain to this box, or was the box made out of purely passive materials, the best of your knowledge, Joe?
Supposedly purely passive, and he said something about also tuning this thing right or turning this thing right, you could get something almost to work in a regenerative phase with the radio. I didn't quite understand that either, but just say that the device is simply a coil and capacitor. Can that by itself act that much to enhance the reception of a broadcast radio if it's placed within the center of this assembly?
I think the answer is no, but I can't be sure, Joe. And it's a matter of where you start and where you end in your comparison. If his completely free transistorized radio is properly oriented, in other words, he's swinging it in azimuth and elevation to pick up on a weak signal that he wants to listen to. He's doing HF band DXing, let's say. And then he measures signal strength by some means. And then he takes that radio and puts it into a box which itself has a coupled resonator of some kind in the box. Yes, when the coupled resonator is off on some other frequency, he's going to get a decrease in performance. And as he tunes that coupled resonator in the box so that it now listens to the same frequency the radio is tuned to, he's going to get better reception. Your real question is, when he finally tunes the box, is it going to be better than the transistor radio all by itself? And it may appear to be better. If he wasn't smart enough to realize that to get best performance out of a transistorized radio, you have to have it properly oriented in azimuth and elevation. A lot of people don't know that. So the possibility is that the box he put it in gave it better orientation, if you know what I mean. But for a purely passive circuit to make a real improvement, I'm having a problem with that. Yes, if he had a huge length of wire out in the backyard, and now that's being brought into the box and resonated I can believe that's going to give you better reception. But something finite in size in wavelength, where we're talking about some number of inches on something that's a 1,000-foot wavelength, I'm having a problem with it. Is there a way, Joe, that you can gather more information as to what he claims is his best performance and whether or not he properly oriented the transistor radio outside of the box to peak the performance before he began this comparison experiment? W2RYY, T2RYW.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, with information.
I'll have to consult him this week when I see him and ask him for some more information, and it may be a few weeks before I get back to you because I'm not working tomorrow, but normally I'm up very, very early in the morning to go to work, so TechNets on Sunday nights is not a thing I've been able to really attend very easily, but I'll try to get some information within the next couple of weeks and get back to you on this as far as specifics, but I will remember what you said about the box antenna, or apparently what he's calling a box antenna, probably helped enhance the azimuth of what was being received to the radio beam just physically because of the way it was put in. But I'll find some more information and get back to you on that. Thanks, Nick.
Very fine, Joe. And John, KD2BD, I wonder if you're an HF band DXer. What kind of equipment have you used, and have you seen enhancement? You've got it, John.
Very good, Dick, and the TechNet, Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. I've used that technique myself, and it does work very well. What you basically have is the wire that's around the box or whatever frame you want to build it on is basically an air core loop antenna, and it's magnetically coupled to the AM radio. And since the AM radio's loop stick is only a couple of percent efficient, this larger diameter resonant circuit that you're building with the coil of wire and the capacitor is a lot better, well, somewhat better efficiency, and it magnetically couples to the loop stick in the radio, and it really, you can take signals that you can just barely hear with the radio itself and couple it to this loop and orient it just right, and they come in, the signals come in very strong, and it requires no power, and it works quite well. K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Yeah, I got a couple of questions for you, John. Number one, what's the brand name and approximate cost of this thing? I think there's a commercial product sold like that. And number two, where you're saying that the loop stick is only a couple of percent efficient, are you sure? And where did those numbers come from? Back to you, John.
Okay, I just grabbed a book here. I believe John Krause's antenna book speaks about that, and they do an example with the loop stick antenna, and they say something about it's only a couple of percent efficient. I'll thumb through the pages while I'm talking to you. Yeah, there is a commercial product, at least it used to be available, called Select Antenna, and that was a round sort of device with a little stand with a knob in the center that connected the variable capacitor, and I imagine around that, or the inside circumference of that enclosure, there was a loop antenna, just a coil of wire, and the capacitor resonated to whatever frequency you wanted to tune in. You put this alongside your radio, and bingo, you got better reception.
Okay, if that external device had a much higher efficiency when it hit resonance than your loop stick, is that really going to stop the insertion loss of the loop stick? That's a tough one. The overall Q is going to go up. I guess the overall coupled circuit of the external resonator plus the loop stick in the radio, is that combination now going to appear to be more efficient? Interesting question. Because the insertion loss or the lack of efficiency of the loop stick in the radio represents a kind of a shunt resistor, so to speak. And just because you've added this external resonating network, that doesn't mean you've gotten rid of that shunt resistor in my equivalent diagram. But sounds to me like you have personally experienced benefit. Got a guess as to how many decibels of benefit and how many dollars this thing costs if it's still manufactured, John? In other words, I think you did say a signal that was just barely copyable. The signal that was just barely copyable with best orientation of the barefoot transistorized radio with this loop stick, and then you use this external select antenna, Did you get a 10 decibel increase gut feel on your part, John? KD2BD, K2RAW?
Your gut feel, I would say 10 dB at least. And I think the way this works is that the loop antenna that you're building, the much larger loop, air core loop antenna that you're building, has a little bit better capture area, a little bit larger capture area. That's the thing that's picking up the signal that you're now receiving with the radio. The loop stick itself, you know, isn't picking up a whole heck of a lot. It's the external antenna that's doing most of the work. I think that select antenna ran for something like $40 or $50. I built something very similar using some tin conductor cable. And I used 8.4 feet of tin conductor cable, and I connected the bottom, and I oriented in a loop in a little wood frame, and I connected the bottom of the tin conductor cable in such a way so that it made a continuous 10-turn loop. So there's 84 feet of wire in that loop. You put a 365 picofarad capacitor across that, and you could tune it, and you could tune from one end of the band to the other. Here's where I'm getting my propaganda about the inefficiency of the loop antenna on the radio. He's giving an example, John Krause in his antenna book, about loopstick antenna. He gives an example about a station at 1 megahertz with 10 kilowatts of broadcast power, yada, 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 signal-to-noise ratio that he's getting. And then at the end of the example, he says, thus an antenna which is less than 0.06% efficient is adequate for AM reception under the circumstances of the above example. So whatever that efficiency is, it doesn't have to be very high for the radio to work because the signals are actually quite strong and the signal-to-noise ratio, you know, is adequate to have a low efficiency antenna. But in certain other circumstances where the signal is weak, you need some extra help. K2RAW, KD2BD.
Yeah, this is good information, John. I'm subtly getting a better impression here. The physical size of an antenna, when it's an extremely small fraction of a wavelength in its dimensions, the physical size of the antenna does not relate to its effective capture area. The Q does, because this larger external device has a higher Q, less loss, when it hits resonance. That in itself, not necessarily because you built it out of physically larger materials, but the fact that it's got a higher Q gives it a higher efficiency, and that increases its effective capture area. That in turn, coupled to your loop stick, I'm now seeing the path by which that can give you an improvement. I'm starting to accept the concept. The Krause's book, Antennas, is that edition 1, 2, or 3 that you're looking at, and what's the chapter you're looking at? What's the chapter number or page number, John? KD2BD, K2RAW.
I'm looking at the second edition. The example for the loop stick begins on or about page 258, 259. He shows a little schematic of a ferrite rod going into the converter of a AM radio. It's on page 260. And then he concludes that example on or about page 262, and that's where I got the efficiency number on the bottom of page 262.
Very well, John. Very well done. I've got editions 1, 2, and 3, so at my leisure, I'm going to look into this one. I like it. As I told you guys, we tap into the brain power, into the tri-state area. John lives in Seagirt, New Jersey, so we're tapping into New Jersey brain power tonight. Awful glad you signed in tonight, John. And looks like you gave us a darn good subject, Ray. here we go. The B2RYY, Joe. Joe, back to you for any final on this one. The B2RYY, K2RAW.
Okay, very good, Dick. I will check into the subject matter some more with the person I talked to about. And I always enjoy bringing a good question up to the TechNet. It just enhances it so much.
KC2WGB, that's John, K2RAW. Hey, John, we got a happy customer there. We got to send him a bill. I'm having some fun with you. Jim is the next guy on the list, KD2BHY. Hey, Jim, of all the crazy subjects, Project Cubidon, what's the latest one in your neighborhood? B-H-Y-R-I-W. You got it, Jim.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Yeah, sorry I couldn't check in last time. I had a question, but my radio wasn't working. But I had a real interesting question this week, and it's really something that I really didn't have a lot of information on, and I just saw it in a QST from this month. And it was about laser modulation. Now, I'm not really sure. I don't really know a lot about the subject. But I looked at my band plan, and it said, I think, like 200 and something gigahertz to light, and then and beyond or something. But I was in QST, and I can't remember. It wasn't an article. I think it was one of those, the percentages of people that do different things, Hamstats, I think it's called. And there was a guy, and he was talking through laser modulation, and I was really confused, and I couldn't find a lot of information on the internet about it. So I was wondering if you could give me some more information on it. Back to you, Dick.
A little bit more, Jim. I'm a member of the North Texas Microwave Society, and they have a monthly journal. And a few of their members, a couple of years ago, established an optical modulated light path of something like 150 miles between two mountains, one in Oklahoma and one in northern Texas. That's one thing to know about. So North Texas Microwave Society, the next time I talk to their former president and editor of the magazine, WA5VJB, Kent Britton, I guarantee you, if I tickle him with those words of light modulation and light ham radio, nanometer ham radio, so to speak, guarantee he'll have a lot of information for me. Here's one other thing that I do know. Quite a number of people have taken a laser pointer, the thing that looks like a pencil you can put in your pocket, whether it's a red one, a green one, or a white one, doesn't matter. And if you build a modulator circuit so that the voltage coming out of your penlight batteries that feeds that thing goes through some kind of a transistorized circuit that makes the voltage go up and down, you can therefore make your laser pen go up and down in its optical output. It's being amplitude modulated. Now you've got across the room or across the yard or a mile away, you've got the right kind of a photo detector. And now it looks for that green light. Maybe it's got a bandpass filter. And it amplifies what the photo detector sees and sends it to a loudspeaker. You'll hear the audio being sent off that modulated light beam. The next step beyond that is to increase the effective capture area of the detector. Put the detector onto the eyepiece of a telescope. And the telescope is aimed at the laser pointer that's doing the transmitting. So by way of modulating the light coming out of a laser pen, you can easily send audio, amplitude modulated audio. I believe a number of people have sent high-speed video television signals by that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's the brute force method of modulating a laser beam. There are very exotic circuits that you can put on the output of the laser beam. The light beam flows through the circuit, and the circuit itself is a Bragg cell modulator, or there's various kinds of crystal-like circuits that as you change the voltage on the crystal, the transparency of the crystal changes, and now you can modulate at a much higher rate, maybe even as much as hundreds of megacycles. So modulating a light beam in amplitude, and almost nobody modulates it in phase yet, but modulating it in amplitude is very doable. It's a fun project. I believe the way the FCC allocates frequencies is that we ham radio operators are allowed to use all above 300 gigahertz. Well, they keep changing where the threshold is, but any frequency higher than 300 gigahertz, you don't have to worry about what frequency band you're on. Are you in the CW portion or the sideband portion if you know what I mean? You own all of it, so to speak, as long as you don't exceed an amount of optical power that could possibly give a person eye injury. So that gives you a little bit of information that I happen to know on that one, Jim. Drag your feet a little bit in case we've got somebody else in the tri-state area with some more brain power that can contribute to this. KD2BHY, with a little bit of delay, K2RAW in the TechNet. You got it, Jim.
Thanks, Vic. It was really confusing when I saw it, and I tried to find some information on the internet, but yeah, there really wasn't a lot. And yeah, it sounds like a fun project, and it'd be easier to do CW, of course. You really would have to turn the laser on and off. But yeah, I'll try to find some more information in some different sources and stuff like that. Thank you for the information, and back to you.
The guys that have decided to send Morse code by optical light don't use simple on-off modulation. When it's on, it's being modulated on and off at a 1 kilohertz rate or a 600 hertz rate. And when it's off, the whole thing is off. So therefore, you don't even need a beat frequency oscillator or a product detector in the receiver. The so-called receiver is really a photo detector into an audio amplifier, into the loudspeaker, into the headphones. But if you modulate the tones on transmit, then you'll hear that tone on reception, and it'll sound like real Morse code. So, I think the next step is sending real audio would be even more fun than sending Morse code. And if you do happen to find a way of adding a optical modulator to your laser pointer, and I vaguely remember there was an article in 73 magazine by Chuck Houghton, slowly coming back to me, a guy in California, used to write a microwave article in 73 magazine way back in the old days, and I think 73 magazine is archived on American Radio Relay League. And was it ham radio? No, it wasn't ham radio, it was 73. So there were some articles in 73 magazine as to how to make optical modulation of a laser pointer. I'll see if I can find some of those during the week, and maybe I'll be sending you some of that information, Jim. And as you find out more about it, come back and tell us about it. Okay, the next person on the list was Ed, KD2 Alpha Delta Charlie, I think it is. Go right ahead, Ed, K2RAW. My name is Dick.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Thanks for taking the question. This question is concerning 2-meter 70-centimeter diplexes. Okay, I constructed one. I designed it using LC, constructed it, and in the process of tuning it up, I was using a AIM UHF vector impedance analyzer to do it. I tuned it to the lowest SWR I could get, and then when I ran the wattage test through it, I found that on the 440 side, I was putting 5 watts in, getting 2 watts out. So I retuned it with just using the watt meter. Okay, I was able to get 5 watts in, 4.8 watts out. And what it looked like is that the 440 side was, I apparently had tuned it to resonance. So I guess my question is that an indication that the inductor capacitor values are an error?
Before I answer that one, let me ask you a question, Ed. The 5 watts of power that you used, was that coming from something like a handy talkie or a mobile rig? What was the source of the signal supplying the 5 watts at 70 centimeters? Over to you, Ed.
Yeah, I was using an HT, and both ends were terminated with a 50-ohm dummy load.
Yeah, you've made the assumption that your handy talkie, which normally feeds a rubber duck antenna, is a 50-ohm source. Most likely it is not. For all we know, it is a 20-ohm source, because that's the particular impedance of the rubber duck. And no two rubber ducks are the same. If you're at a flea market and you want to buy a replacement rubber duck for your handy talkie for 70 centimeters, the guy selling them will say, what model number and brand name is your rig? To which you say, all I need is one with a BNC connector. Does it matter? And he'll say, yes, it does. Because the way each manufacturer does the impedance match between the final stage of the transmitter and their particular rubber duck is not the same. So that when you tuned it up with the handy talkie as the source into the diplexer, and then you tune the inductors and capacitors of the diplexer so you get best power output, you now were probably matching the impedance of your handy talkie. In other words, you are tuning your In my example, if your particular handy-talkie had a 20-ohm output impedance, and some of them do, they work on 50 ohms, but you don't get maximum performance there. So if yours had a 20-ohm output impedance, and you adjusted the circuitry of your diplexer to maximum power, you didn't know it, but you were really matching to 20 ohms on the input side. You got to worry a little bit now when you do that kind of retuning compared to the original design. Does it still have the same selectivity? And I think the answer is going to be yes. In other words, your common port is the antenna, and the two other output ports are the 2-meter output and the 70-centimeter output, and you'd like them to act in an independent manner. The signal coming down the antenna is 2 meters, and you'd like 98% of the power to appear at the 2-meter output, and none of them appear on the 70-centimeter output. By way of your vector impedance measuring setup, I think you'll be able to find out how much is the isolation, how much is the insertion loss, and so on. So retuning a filter-like device in the real environment, which in many cases differs quite a bit from 50-ohm laboratory test equipment, that's part of what I think you're experiencing, Ed. KD2, Alpha Delta Charlie, K2RAW.
K2RAW, KD2ADC. Okay, thanks, Dick. That answers some of the question that I had, because, I mean, I did get it to work, and I was getting a separation of about 95%. You know, if you're putting a signal into the 2-meter side, you know, what was coming out of the 440 side was maybe like an eighth of a watt, something like that. But, yeah, I guess I could have, the output impedance of the handy talkie could account for that. Go ahead.
It turns out to measure the output impedance of a transmitter requires rather different circuitry. If you had something like a double stub tuner or a triple stub tuner with a 50 ohm termination on one end and the input end is your handy talkie, and now you adjust the double stub tuner or triple stub tuner until you get maximum power into the 50 ohm load, and then you use instrumentation to find out what is the input impedance of the double stub tuner. And that's an indirect way of finding out what was the real impedance of your handy talkie. It's academic, you don't really need to know. But I think you did it sort of automatically. And by the way, if you were getting, let me pick a number, 2.8 watts output versus 4.8 watts output when you did the retuning, that's only approximately a 2.5 or a 3 dB increase. That's not a showstopper. It's nice to have all the efficiency you can get, but I guarantee you without the retuning, the original design, you still would have been on the air, and had you not been as academic as you are to make these measurements, you would never have known that everything wasn't hunky-dory, if you know what I mean. Back to you, and as you find out more information on your network, come back and let us know about it, Ed. Also, the original design of your diplexer, where did it come from? KD2 ADC, K2RAW.
KD2 ADC returning. Actually, I designed it with the LC program that came with the ARL handbook, and I designed it for 50 ohm impedance out. I put in a zero ripple for the passband, and the values that I got was, I wound the inductors to those values, and I wound the inductors using the impedance analyzer at the crossover frequency. So my question was, I guess, because I did tune it with the impedance analyzer, it was terminated with 50 ohm load, tuned it with the impedance analyzer to the lowest SWR, and then when I measured the output, it appeared that the 440 side was about half of what the handy talkie was putting out. When I retuned it, I was getting 5 in, 4.8 out, and the SWR was still good at the handy talkie side. And I went back to the impedance analyzer, ran that scan again, and I was getting about a 1.5 to 1. So I was just wondering if I was tuning the 440 side into resonance with the impedance analyzer. Go ahead.
Now, the word resonance and the word diplexing filter, I've got 20 meanings here. And by the way, when you selected 0 decibels of ripple, you did a compromise. It makes good sense to do that. Had you chosen 0.5 dB or 1 dB ripple, It's kind of a Chebyshev filter. As you allow the ripple to increase in the passband, the skirt selectivity gets better and better. Therefore, the amount of isolation between the 2 meter and the 440 would have gotten better had you allowed some ripple. At first, the ripple sounds undesirable, but you can easily set it up in such a way that you're getting half a dB or 1 dB ripple, but the peak of the ripple falls on your favorite frequency. Therefore, you don't see the disadvantage of the ripple, if you know what I mean. So you could go back and recheck that design with greater amount of ripple if you wanted to. And once you design a Chebyshev filter, it's a kind of filter that has a flat top response to it. And maybe yours in its original design would be passing 440 to 450 in its passband and then falling off very rapidly in between. So in that flat top 10 megacycle wide passband, do you call that resonance? I would call it tuning. I would call it proper, what do they call it? There's a fancy name they use for filters now. I can't think of a word for it. Call it resonance if you like, but there's more involved in what a Chebyshev filter is. Good luck with that project, Ed, and let us know as you find more about it, as you dig into it. And homebrewing your own diplexing filter. Reasonably brave. Well done. Wes was the next guy on the list. But before I go there, I know that you checked in to say something to me, John, but there was a double and I didn't get your message, so I better find out what your message was. And hopefully we're also going to get Ray K2CYR signing in on circular polarization. KC2.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2WGB for the message. K2RAW. Go ahead, John. Hello, John. Maybe he got called away for a minute. Wes, go ahead with your antenna question. WS2N. Here we go. Wrong guy. N2XJN. K2RAW. Go ahead, Wes.
Okay. Actually, it's a complex question that I have for you. And I sent you two emails. That's a part one and part two. In part one, I relate to the subject of the thickness of the wire. And then I continue that with the nice gentleman that was actually taking stand on it through the email, which is Roy Laufer. And I like his approach to that. Intriguing. Anyhow, if you were to have the wire for the antenna and you want to have theoretically the thinnest one, what would then be the minimum thickness required from the serious resonance circuit while in resonance? Forget about when it's not in resonance, just in resonance. We're not dealing with the problems out of resonance. Sirius is capacitor and inductance. The antenna might represent also Sirius resonance circuit. Now, this, after that is how then the minimum thickness will be for the parallel resonance circuit, the parallel resonance circuit in antenna pattern. Enter.
I think I know what your question is. I'm going to give an example for a typical 80-meter dipole out in free space. Full-size 80-meter dipole in free space. The average guy builds it out of 14-gauge household copper wire with or without the rubber insulation on there. That's his choice. 132 feet long, split in the center, egg insulator in the center, and hopefully he feeds it with a ballon-like device going to his transmission line. Now if the guy wants to make the antenna invisible because he's got a landlord that won't let him put up an antenna, he's stringing the antenna in between two buildings of this apartment complex and he wants the antenna to disappear. And he starts doing a set of experiments where he builds an antenna out of 14 gauge, 18 gauge, 22 gauge, 30 gauge, 36 gauge, and 40 gauge wire. Assuming he can keep the 40 gauge wire physically strong enough that it doesn't break in the wind, if you know what I mean. And he starts running a series of experiments. what he's going to discover is that as the wire gets smaller and smaller in diameter on this 80-meter dipole in my example, because of the skin effect, the RF energy only sees the top 10,000th of an inch of the copper, and he's getting into smaller and smaller diameter. He's getting less and less surface area of the wire that the RF energy can flow through. The net result of that is he now is building a distributed resistor along the length of the wire as he makes the wire smaller and smaller in diameter. Let me drop. The distributed resistor has got a good piece of good news and a piece of bad news. The good news is as he sweeps the antenna and looks at the standing wave ratio, the finer gauge wire with the distributed resistance will look like it's got more bandwidth to it. It'll have a lower Q. At first, with his instrumentation, that'll look good. And when he's doing receiving on 80 meters, because the noise in the background on 80 meters is equivalent to about a 40 decibel noise figure. In other words, the atmospheric noise is so loud, the fact that the antenna is lower in efficiency because of the distributed resistance, which means it picks up less noise and it picks up less signal, but the signal-to-noise ratio will stay the same. On reception, he will not know the difference, except the fact that the S meter won't move quite as high, but the signals will sound the same under most conditions. When he starts transmitting into it, that distributed resistance is only going to take a certain number of watts before the antenna burns up. If he built it out of 36 gauge and 40 gauge wire and he wants to put a kilowatt into it, it's going to last about 1 second. And after that, it's gone, if you know what I mean. So the resonance phenomena will look like it's a little bit more broadband. The distributed resistance to it will give him this lower efficiency. And it's a trade-off. If you've got a landlord that won't allow you to put up an antenna and you want to make it invisible by using buttons for the insulators and 36-gauge wire, and guys have done that, 30 and 36-gauge wire, it does work. It's not perfect, but it's a good compromise. Maybe that's part of the information you're looking for, Wes. N2XJN, KQIIW.
Okay, the skin effect is more visible due to the frequency increase. That's one of the parts of the story. The second part of the story is we have a perfectly matched antenna with the frequency of transmission, or frequency of oscillation. So the resonance is there. Now, how much the tune-up of the antenna varies due to the wire thickness and to extreme.
If I was winding a solenoid coil, let me say an inch in diameter, and I'm going to wind 10 turns, and it's going to be along a cylindrical insulated object that's 2 inches long, and I'm going to put a capacitor across it to resonate it. And if I started off by building it with a piece of 16-gauge wire, and then I repeat the experiment with a piece of 26-gauge wire, and then I repeat the experiment with a piece of 36-gauge wire, again, because of the distributed resistance of the wire in that solenoid coil, let me drop... The distributed resistance of that solenoid coil will give me something that'll look almost the same on my laboratory instrumentation into my vector network analyzer, but I will see with the finer gauge wire slightly lower Q. It'll have a little bit more bandwidth. And if I start measuring its efficiency, one way I could measure efficiency is to put a known amount of power into it and do a calorimetry experiment. Find out how much heat is given off by the coil of wire at a known amount of power or voltage going into it. So many people have asked the question, gee, I could build this IF can for my radio, my transistorized radio, out of a 30-gauge wire. How much better will the IF can be if I make it out of 24-gauge wire? And there are people who have done studies like that. In general, the rate of change of performance for most circumstances is fairly slow. However, if I'm now trying to build a resonator at 1296 megacycles, all of a sudden I'm not going to be building that out of 36 gauge wire for a whole bunch of reasons. Up in frequency, skin effect is smaller, resistance is higher, circulating currents are greater for a finite size, and so on. By the way, that resonator and that dipole antenna, in both cases, signal is bouncing back and forth between the ends of the dipole 20 times before it gets radiated, either on transmit or receive. In the case of your LC resonator sitting on the bench, the signal is bouncing back and forth between the inductor and capacitor. And how much gets absorbed on each bounce is a function of the amount of resistance of the wire. And the resistance of the wire is a function of, is it copper, is it aluminum, is it 26 gauge, 36 gauge. These are some of the variables you can play with. And you could, if you want to, do a very similar experiment. And that is, instead of changing from 24 gauge wire to 36 gauge wire.
Repeater, timeout, repeater.
Instead of changing the diameter of the wire, if the new diameter of finer wire acts like there's three more ohms at the radio frequency, and instead of going from 26 gauge to 36 gauge, you plug in a 3-ohm resistor in series with that coil, and then put it across the capacitor and resonate it, it'll behave just about the same. So whether the resistor in that coil is lumped together in one spot at one end of the coil, or whether the resistance is distributed throughout the coil, the effect will be very similar. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Okay. Larger diameter and antenna wire lowers the wavelength at resonance. True or false?
A true, but by a very slow amount. If I measured the length of a 80-meter dipole, 132 feet, with 14-gauge wire, and I decided to build it out of 10-gauge wire, instead of being 132 feet long, it's going to be 131.5 feet long. Very slow change. If you go to the Brown and Woodward curves, Brown and Woodward, which is in Chapter 4 of almost every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, or you can also go to the website at WA1MGA, I think it's WA1MGA, Mike Alpha Alpha. You go to WA1MGA.org, and you go to the bottom of the page, the K2RIW Yagi section. There you'll find a copy of the Brown and Woodward curves. Brown and Woodward, back in 1948, did a man-year of work. They built a whole lot of antennas out of every possible diameter and length that you could care about. And one curve tells you for the diameter of the wire and the length, you know, this is how much resistive impedance you'll have. The second curve tells you how much reactive impedance you'll have versus length and diameter. So in other words, how the resonance of your antenna changes as a function of diameter of wire, you don't have to do the experiment. You just find the right curve. Mr. Brown and Woodward spent a man-year of their life gathering that data for you. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Okay. Based on what you said is that, like, if we have one-to-one SWR, we do not have a dead point indication that the antenna system is resonant or is in resonance, and that SWR is only the ratio between the impedances of the feed line and antenna load. So then if we connect 50 ohm pure resistor across the 50 ohm transition line, there will be one-to-one SWR, but there will be no radiation from the resistor. So the example that you gave with the capacitor and the coil, which would then represent the rest of the inductance, that would behave some sort of similar to the wire of the antenna, is simply the efficiency of the wire difference, or of the antenna difference only, and to exist.
This is going to sound like it's a little bit off to one side, but I'm going to give you an additional piece of information, which I think is what you're looking for. That 80-meter dipole out of 14-gauge wire or 10-gauge wire, rather minor difference. If I'm building a 432-megacycle dipole, which ordinarily is going to be around 12 inches long, and now I have the ability, with materials I can easily get my hands on, where I can build that 432 dipole out of wire that's 14 gauge in diameter, all the way up to 2 inches in diameter. And I can do it with squirrel by a birdcage-like wiring arrangement, if you know what I mean. I could make the equivalent of a 432 megacycle dipole out of what looks like wire, 2 inches diameter, very fat, rounded off dipole. When you start going that fat in diameter, which is the tail end of the Brown and Woodward curves, now you're going to see a significant difference. Instead of that dipole being 12 inches long when it's out of 14-gauge wire, and now you build it 2 inches in diameter, I don't know the exact number, but maybe it's going to turn out to be 8 inches long instead of 12 inches long. You're going to start getting a substantial difference in length at resonance. One other thing that the Brown and Woodward curves will tell you is that the resistive component of your antenna, once you've chosen the diameter wire, let me drop. The resistive component changes in a very predictable manner as you change length of the dipole. Therefore, I don't care if you're using 300-ohm transmission line or 25-ohm transmission line. Choose the right length of the dipole, and you will make the resistive component anything you want between 1 ohm and 1,000 ohms. If my favorite transmission line is 72-ohm transmission line, all I've got to do is choose the right length of that dipole, and it will have a resistive component of 72 ohms. That's the good news. In almost all cases, the Brown-Woodward curves will tell you that for that length, there's going to be some reactance left over, capacitance or inductance. And if you're willing to put the shunt capacitor across the center of the dipole to tune out the reactive component, the problem goes away. That article is on the bottom end of Tom's page, wa1mba.whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org, the K2RIW section. An article explaining all of that is there with those Brown and Woodward curves. So to make your dipole a perfect impedance match at your favorite frequency is very simple. It's amazing how well kept a secret that is. Just choose the length. You've got the resistor component. Put the right reactor across the center. The reactance goes away. Now the dipole is a perfect one-to-one match at your favorite frequency. I don't care if it's an 80-meter dipole or a 1296 dipole. You can do that. Does it make some sense, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW?
It does. In other words, you say that any piece of conducting material will work as an antenna on any frequency. And it is because in some small inductance in any wire or strip of the metal or the resistor, that will allow some radiation to escape into the space. So the main objective would be to build an antenna that will function properly, primarily as a radiator of RF rather than generator of the heat. And also, what you're saying is that the only reason to build any antenna that would be more sophisticated antenna is to control radiation pattern and to exceed.
Once you go beyond a dipole by building a phased array of them or building a Yagi-like structure because you're putting a bunch of parasitic directors in front and a reflector out back, only when you add extra real estate to the dipole by making the dipole longer than a half wavelength or adding these extra doodads or using an array of dipoles, then for the first time you can control the radiation pattern, the beam width, and you can pick up some extra gain. But for all practical purposes, reasonable performance dipoles, every one of them has got the exact same gain and the exact same pattern within half a dB. You can't make a high gain dipole and a low gain dipole if you're using low loss materials. You have to invest in real estate if you want to start restricting the beam width. That's what a horn does, that's what a parabolic dish does, that's what a Yagi does. All of these higher gain antennas, you've made an investment of more real estate. You're lighting up a bigger chunk of space with your transmitted energy at the antenna, and that's where the directivity is coming from. I'm going to move on. Bernie was the next guy on the list. K2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bernie.
Okay, good evening, Dick. I'm on my HT. I just want to make sure I'm making the repeater okay.
You sound beautiful. Little bit of hiss in the background, but we're hearing every one of your golden words. Go ahead, Bernie.
Okay, great. I'm surrounded by apartment buildings here. I'm on the second floor, so if I move just a little bit, I don't make it, so I've got to stay frozen here. I got a two-part question about grounding, and this was inspired by listening to the conversation last night on the repeater. Glenn had mentioned something called grounding loop, something called a ground loop. I had asked John about this earlier, the two-part question. I was hoping you could elucidate it. One is, I didn't quite understand what a ground loop is, except that John explained to me it could wreak havoc with test equipment or something to that effect. So that one is, what is this about ground loop about? And number two is, if I have a dipole out the window, or just about any, I run those thin wire antennas very successfully. I've done that forever. Works great. I guess the biggest expense in my antenna system is the coax, because the rest are just 32 gauge spools of wire. But anyway, if I connect the radio to the ground pin of the electrical outlet, I notice that the signal goes up dramatically on receive. Let me just drop it so I can finish. Particularly on the lower bands, so there'll be a dramatic difference in the receive signal if I connect that radio to that electrical ground. John said something about it being connected to the earth ground and RF signal. If you could just comment on that, how that works. Maybe I just imagined it, but I always just probably made it up in my head. But if a chassis is connected to electrical ground, then the potential voltages compared to zero, that your zero voltage is more zero and the unit works better, if you know what I mean. Maybe I just imagined that. But that's my two-part question. I listen a lot and really enjoy it, so I will be standing by and listening. K2MU.
Okay, Bernie. There are various opinions on the case of RF grounding, and the most popular opinion, which differs a little bit from what you'll find in the Polyphaser catalog on lightning protection. Polyphaser is a company that makes lightning protection devices, but they've got a $20 book that gives you a lot of information, and theirs differs a little bit by what is the popular opinion we've been hearing from Glenn and others. Glenn and John and others are fairly convinced that if the coax cables coming from your antennas that are on the roof or on the tower in the backyard, if those cables become grounded with a separate grounding rod outside the house, and there is no grounding wire from that earth ground into the grounding inside the house. The grounding inside the house, they tend to keep it separate. The grounding inside the house goes to water pipes and a fuse panel and whatever. So they have somewhat separate grounds. Their philosophy, and maybe they're right, their philosophy, if a lightning bolt comes down that coax cable of yours, you want it to be grounded locally outside the house. You don't want it to have a simple, easy path for the couple inside the house and to contaminate the house with lightning. Well, the coax cable is doing that. And I guess if you're a super conservative person, you disconnect the coax cables on the back of all your rigs when a lightning storm is around. So that's one kind of grounding philosophy. Glenn has lived in the lightning capital of the world, near Gainesville, Florida, which has a greatest number of lightning strikes anywhere in the USA. He's lived within a few miles of there and survived it, tried various techniques to survive and to get least amount of damage of his equipment. So therefore, he's got a lot of experience that works for him, and maybe he's right. Let me drop. Now, on the subject of grounding loop currents and so on, I've got an opinion on this one. Because you're going to be running a number of grounding wires, maybe, on various pieces of equipment, the way you dress that cable makes a difference. Even though I might take three pieces of equipment and the three power cords from that equipment all go to the same wall socket, so to speak, with an octopus on it. And so you think you've got a common point of grounding. However, if one of those power cables wraps over the top of a power transformer that's inside of a cabinet of some other piece of equipment, and the other two wrap underneath it, because you have dressed those two cables differently, because that transformer in that piece of equipment is sending out an external magnetic field, and the way you have dressed those wires were not all the same. They weren't coupled together in one common piece of, wrapped together, all three of them with tie wraps. They were dressed individually, and they took a separate path. Now the magnetic field coming out of that transformer can induce a positive voltage on the upper wire and a negative voltage on the two bottom wires, and now you've got a voltage difference across your wires that you think are grounded. And it may only be a fraction of a volt, but in certain circumstances that can give you some grief. That's one kind of grounding loop. There's another kind of grounding loop due to current flow that happens in hospitals. Let me drop. If I've got an error in the wiring of a piece of medical equipment that I'm using in this particular room of the hospital, and I'm doing a very delicate operation, I am catheterizing a patient. In other words, there's a conductive fluid inside this catheter. The catheter is going down the vein or artery of a human being, and it is going near his heart. So now there's a conductive path through that fluid, through that catheter, coming back to the piece of instrumentation he might be using. Maybe it's fiber optics or whatever. And the method by which you isolate and ground the instrumentation in the room where you're doing the operation, compared to a fault in the wiring so that somebody running a vacuum cleaner two rooms away, the vacuum cleaner draws a whole lot of current, and because of an error in the vacuum cleaner wiring, it